I am a huge believer in the power of AI to make a very positive difference in the world. And I think we have to stipulate, look, AI will be the most powerful technology of our lifetime. It will change everything, how we live, how we work, certainly how we defend our digital world. AI is going to help create capabilities that can identify and detect a cyber attack before it gets near to making an impact. We talk about domains of warfare, the five domains: airspace, land, sea, and cyberspace. But in the world of cyber, there really is a sixth domain. And in many ways, it's the most important domain, and that's the private sector. The vast majority of critical infrastructure, and when I say critical infrastructure, it's not a technical term, Simon. It's water, it's power, it's healthcare, it's finance, it's transportation, it's communications, it's what drives our daily life. The vast majority is owned and operated by the private sector. So the private sector, more than any entity, is on the front lines of those battles. And frankly, it's why it is absolutely so critical that everything that we do in cyberspace is rooted in catalyzing the right collaboration between the government and the private sector to enable us to reduce risk to that critical infrastructure.
We've had some extremely distinguished guests over the last 6 years, but we haven't secured one who combined being a Rhodes Scholar, a US Army colonel, serving two terms at the White House, a counterterrorism expert leading the US's Cyber Intelligence Defense Agency, and one who lectures at Oxford and beyond, whilst also being hired into the private sector and working for Morgan Stanley. But today, armed with her intellect and unusually not with her trademark cowboy boots, we've secured our target and are thrilled to welcome Jen Easterly to our offices. Welcome, Jen.
Thank you, Simon. Great to be with you.
Well, I need to say, first of all, a big thank you to our mutual friend, Rob Rooney, who was at Morgan Stanley, ended up as CEO of Morgan Stanley International, who made the introduction. And I know you're on your way to Oxford where you lecture, and we're going to come back to that later on. But let's just retreat for a moment. Was yours a disciplined, ordered, and organized upbringing?
No, it was not, which is surprising. My 21 years in the military, but I wouldn't say it was particularly disciplined. I grew up in a family that was very focused on, I think, two things. One, sort of intellectual pursuits, in particular literature and poetry. My mom was a PhD, English literature professor at Bryn Mawr College. My dad was a writer, actually a speech writer, started out as a speech writer for Richard Nixon. Interesting upbringing. But I grew up in a family that, you know, memorized poetry, and we always had, you know, huge debates about what was going on in the world. So that was sort of one piece of it. And the second piece was all about service. You know, my dad was in government. He was a Vietnam veteran. That was really what inspired my military service. And my mom served in government as well after she left teaching at Bryn Mawr. But I was not a particularly disciplined kid. I mean, I did well in school, but I was somebody who would kind of do my own thing. And I think I found school to be a bit easy, so I didn't have to work that terribly hard. So I did other things. I was really into music. I wanted to work because I wanted to make my own money. So, you know, I was a bank teller. Maybe that was sort of foretelling my experience at Morgan Stanley. But went off to Italy where I was an exchange student, and then went back my senior year just to kind of hang out. So, you know, I grew up in a family that really encouraged intellectual pursuits, hard work, but, you know, discipline was not the main word that would have come to my mind, actually, probably, sadly.
Okay, well, maybe not. So I was trying to weigh up. You go to Oxford, Pembroke. Did you study PPE there?
I did. Yeah, that's what everybody studied back in those days. Okay.
And you're at West Point, you know, which is, you know, it's more than the UK's equivalent of Sandhurst because it's, I think, a four-year course.
Yeah.
But, you know, smart, you're thinking about the options. You may have had that history in the family of the Army, but what ultimately made you think, yeah, I want to be in the U.S. Army?
Yeah. I mean, it really was my dad. So his experience, he grew up, is interesting. He didn't have a father growing up. He was, you know, illegitimate back in those days. You know, his mom, I think, had him at 18. And then she ended up marrying the town barber, who eventually adopted my dad, but really beat him really, really badly. It was a terrible upbringing. And he ended up dropping out of high school and going off to join the army and ended up in the early days of the Vietnam conflict. So was there from 62 to 63 with the Army Security Agency. So early on in those days doing what we would consider now signals intelligence out of Thompson Hood Air Force Base in Vietnam. And look, it was he was an intellectually curious, but pretty disaffected kid. And it opened the world to him in a way that I think set the course for the rest of his life. You know, he got to learn another culture. He met incredible people. He fell in love. You know, all of these things. That was not my mom, by the way, but all of these things that influenced him. And he used to tell me all these stories when I was a little kid. And they really impacted my desire to serve, to be in the Army. And, you know, I don't know when that actually sort of occurred to me that I should go to West Point, but I know I always wanted to be in the Army. I think in my mid-teens, I decided, hey, it'd be great to be an officer, to go to West Point, the premier U.S. military academy. And so I applied early. I got in early. I made the big mistake of never visiting the school before I actually got there. So when I arrived on a very hot morning in July of 1986, I was pretty poorly prepared for the physical rigors, for the mental stresses, for the emotional pressures. And, you know, 1986, women had only been there for 10 years. So there were still a lot of people, a lot of cadets, a lot of professors, a lot of officers, staff who didn't want women there. So it was really a pretty difficult and trying environment. And I remember in the early days wanting to quit many times, but not wanting to go back home and having quit and sort of, you know, I'd never failed anything before and I didn't want to start with failing at college. But it was a tough environment, you know, throughout that time and frankly throughout my life. My dad has kind of been my inspiration and he's been the person that I've always gone back to get advice. And, you know, frankly, it's made a huge difference in my life to have somebody that I can always rely upon as a source of advice and inspiration.
Fantastic. Well, fast forward as you see various theaters of conflict, as you've understood, you end up being asked to run the first U.S. Cyber Battalion, and that's going to start leading us down this path where you've been. Tell, you know, how did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting story. So it's a bit of a long story. I'll try and make it short. But I ended up at the National Security Agency, sort of the largest, most powerful intelligence agency of the world, in the world. And this was in the mid-2000s. So this was after the Iraq War started. And in 2006, I was what's called the chief of the Cryptologic Services Group. So in charge of all of our forces on the ground in Iraq that were deployed from NSA, the National Security Agency. And during that time, you'll remember, and I think you've talked to General Petraeus several times. So he had just been put in as the commander of multinational forces Iraq. And the insurgency was at the apex of its strength, violence at an all-time high. And terrorists were using these crude materials to create homemade bombs. We called them improvised explosive devices, or IEDs. And they were having catastrophic impacts, killing thousands of troops, thousands of Iraqi civilians. And so my team and I were tasked with this, essentially operationalizing and deploying a new high technology platform. It was called Real-Time Regional Gateway, highly classified, top secret at the time, you know, all since declassified. But the idea was to take all the massive amounts of data we were collecting in theater about these bomb-making networks, whether it was from satellites or cell phones or reporting from troops, and then figure out how to integrate it and correlate it and enrich it so we could illuminate those bomb-making networks, not in days and weeks when it was useless information, but in hours and minutes, and provide that information to the troops on the ground to pursue and disrupt those terrorist networks. And it was probably one of the hardest things that I've ever done. We had this team of coders sitting in a van in the middle of a base in Baghdad, and You can imagine, Simon, it was mortar fire and rocket fire and machine gun fire in the near distance. And, you know, it was incredible at that point in time because the stakes were so high. And the team was coding up the system, and it was literally failure after failure after failure after failure. But after about 6 weeks, we were able to get the system up and running, and it ultimately provided a capability to the forces on the ground, including the special forces commanded by Stan McChrystal at the time, to take thousands and thousands of insurgents off the battlefield and save thousands and thousands of lives. And because of the success of that, that's when I came back from Iraq and was asked by the director of the National Security Agency, a guy called Keith Alexander, who was interestingly the West Point classmate of Dave Petraeus.
Right.
So these are all go back to my time at West Point and what a fundamental impact that that has had on my career. He saw what I was able to do to bring together technology, communications, to really have an impact on a very hard technical problem that related to saving lives. And so that's where he asked me to kind of build and stand up and command the Army's first cyber operations battalion, which was about both how do you defend networks, but also how do you project power in cyberspace and develop a platform to be able to do that effectively.
Right. So again, we are fast forwarding because we're going to get to the whole cyber environment in which we operate right now.
Yeah.
But to you, the appointment that was perhaps then the most senior appointment was when, you know, President Biden appoints you to create, run NISA. So just what was the objective?
Yeah. So, we're jumping around. Okay, so we went from Iraq, then we went to, I was actually, you know, as you mentioned, at Morgan Stanley, there as the head of our Cyber Fusion Center and then head of cyber resilience, having a fantastic time working with our mutual friend, Rob Bruni. During that time, I was asked by a friend of mine to come back and lead cyber policy for the transition team. Because I'm not a political person. I'm a lifelong independent who worked for President Bush and President Obama, but was asked to do specifically on the cyber policy side, given my experience. So I was there, actually, interestingly, the transition happened during one of the biggest cyber attacks on U.S. government networks, now known as the SolarWinds attack. It was actually Russia using a supply chain attack, using updating your software to actually put a corrupted update into U.S. government networks. So pretty serious attack. And because of that, I ultimately was asked to be in charge of CISA, which is the Cyber Security and Infrastructure Security Agency, one of the newest agencies in the federal government. And that was really America's cyber defense agency. And so ultimately came back from Morgan Stanley to lead and build a capability to help defend the U.S. in cyberspace and really to work with our partners around the world to help defend collective cyberspace. And then the other piece of that was really focused on the defense and resilience of critical infrastructure. And, you know, frankly, I'd been in government for almost 30 years, but the most important preparation for that particular job was my almost 5 years at Morgan Stanley, really understanding how a critical infrastructure entity in finance helps to defend itself in a world that is so complex and so vulnerable and so connected. And so that was great preparation for the job at CISA.
The Money Maze podcast is proudly sponsored by the London Stock Exchange Group, a global leader in financial markets infrastructure. LSEG has a rich history of facilitating capital flows, empowering businesses, and connecting investors to opportunities. Today, they provide world-class technology, data, and analytics, playing a critical role in shaping modern finance. From their role in sustainable investing to their contributions to financial innovation, LSEG is helping to build a more connected and efficient market. Visit LSEG.com via the link in the show notes to see how they're driving the future of finance. In times of economic and geopolitical volatility, investors will look to gold. Today, as the world navigates uncertainty and heightened risk, investors of all sorts will look to safeguard their wealth. We're thrilled to welcome the World Gold Council as one of our sponsors. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more or visit goldhub.org on your browser for comprehensive research, insights, and analysis on the global gold market. Just tell us a little bit about how how you feel you acquitted yourself in what is, you know, it's a new business, essentially, like many of us are facing today with this disintermediation.
Yeah. So, you know, it was super interesting, right? Because I've stood up organizations throughout my career. This was probably one of the biggest ones. So CISA, which was built in 2018, was very new, but it was sort of built off the back of existing infrastructure, so staff infrastructure. So when I took it over, it was about 2,000 people and then a contractor force of about 5,000 or 6,000. When I left, it was sort of total of about 10,000. We ended up hiring almost 2,500 people, which was a major challenge because, you know, at the end of the day, people don't come to government to make money. but it was a challenge that I think was underpinned by the imperative of the mission and also the culture we were able to build there where, you know, people really wanted to be collaborative, be innovating, and be focused on service to the American people in a very complex threat environment. But, you know, at the end of the day, the things that drove me in that job and what we build, I would comes down to a couple of things. First, the imperative to be able to collaborate between the public sector and the private sector. And that is all underpinned by trust. And so being able to create trusted relationships across the federal government, across the business sector, across the technology community, across the international community. And we were pretty successful in doing that. One thing that we did that I think was really important was in the aftermath of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we launched a campaign called Shields Up to really help businesses, large and small, defend themselves from potential Russian retaliatory cyber attacks in the aftermath of that invasion. That was, again, a real credit to the strong international partnerships that we had catalyzed and that continue to be incredibly important in today's highly dynamic threat environment. We also worked very closely with CEOs and boards to advance this concept of corporate cyber responsibility, and that's managing cyber risk as a strategic business risk, not as something you delegate to the IT teams, right? Not something that's just a compliance issue, but something that actually has to be owned by the CEO and the board and managed as a matter of good governance. So we really advanced that whole idea working with board directors, and that was really important. And the third thing that we did that was also really important was advance this idea that we don't actually have a cybersecurity problem in the world. We have a software quality problem. And the issue is we have not enforced accountability on the makers of software. Rather, we've just blamed companies who've been hacked or individuals who fall victim to phishing. We have not taken enough time to actually enforce accountability on the quality of software. So we launched something called a Secure by Design campaign, which really, working with vendors, got them to recognize that they needed to design and develop and test and deliver software that was much more secure and much more resilient.
So I'm going to go slightly off terrain because in the last few months, the listed software sector in the US particularly, but globally, has been hammered as people have started to think about, you know, why AI will substitute much of that. Now, to the extent that some of these things are knowable, how might the rapid advancement in AI actually help address some of those limitations in software design?
Yeah, I mean, I should say, look, I talked about my experience in Iraq and you know, being in an environment where you can use technology to truly save lives, frankly, you know, that was the beginning of my love affair with technology and my obsession with the power of data and frankly, the power of imagination to be able to make a positive impact in the world. And that's why I am so excited about AI. You're going to hear a lot of people talk about how AI is going to, you know, lead to the end of the world. Mm-hmm. But I am a huge believer in the power of AI to make a very positive difference in the world. And I think we have to stipulate, look, AI will be the most powerful technology of our lifetime. It will change everything, how we live, how we work, certainly how we defend our digital world. And in many ways, it's not just a technology. It is a fundamental shift in how we approach really every single problem. you know, whether it's in finance or whether it's in cybersecurity. In cybersecurity, AI is going to help create capabilities that can identify and detect a cyber attack before it gets near to making an impact, can deploy countermeasures in trilliseconds and learn from every attempt to breach them. But, you know, as you know, technology is not good or bad, right? It's neutral. And, you know, I love this great quote from the French philosopher Paul Virilio. You probably know it. He said, you know, when you invent the ship, you also invent the shipwreck. When you invent the plane, you also invent the plane crash. When you invent electricity, you also invent electrocution. So every technology brings with it negativity that is invented at the exact same time as technical progress. And so even as we look to be able to leverage AI for good, we also have to be very mindful of the risks that can be implicated by AI. And we're already starting to see threat actors use AI to create hyper-personalized, hyper-tailored phishing emails that will be incredibly hard to detect. But I think the thing is, if we are able to create these capabilities to be secure, and that is the big if, Simon, that's the thing that I think everybody is truly grappling with who cares about safety and security, is how do we make sure these very powerful capabilities do not destroy massive parts of our economy, have terrible effects on society, but actually serve humanity. I think if we are able, though, to ensure the security of these capabilities, and we can certainly talk more about how we do that, AI can actually solve that software quality problem I talked about. And that's because increasingly powerful AI can actually see the flaws and the defects that exist in software, can see them, can understand them, and then can refactor them. So think about the green rain that you see in the Matrix movie. You can imagine that green rain turning from insecure, flawed products into secure, resilient code in an instantaneous way, using these capabilities, again, to address insecure code. I was reading, interestingly, in our old place at Morgan Stanley, one of the things the technology team is doing is using their own bespoke capabilities based on ChatGPT to actually rewrite some of the very old code that they've had for years. You probably know COBOL is used on mainframes, being able to rewrite that in a way where they can actually make that code much more secure, doing millions and millions of lines of code using AI, saving hundreds of thousands of hours of manpower. So there's some really, really cool things that can be done across critical infrastructure, including the financial services sector, using AI. But again, all of this is predicated on making sure that it is built to be secure.
Got it. So let's go to the battlefield. Two quotations for you to respond to. Sir Jeremy Fleming, former head of GCHQ intelligence chief, said, never seen threats on this scale. And the new MI6 head with his lovely James Bondy name, Blaise Metrowelli, has said that the front line is no longer somewhere else. It's everywhere. No. How do we think about these, the geopolitical actors and the attendant threats?
Yeah. Well, I think first it's important to contextualize where we are in the threat environment, right? When I think back about that time in Iraq in 2007, and we thought we were dealing with these massive, massive amounts of data, now looking back on it, it's actually a bit ironic and frankly a little bit quaint, because I was in Iraq in 2007, head down, focused on the adversary and these bomb-making networks. Back here in Silicon Valley in the Moscone Center, Steve Jobs was introducing the world to the first iPhone, January of 2007. So just think about that interesting juxtaposition, you know, introducing the world to something that has literally changed the way we work and live. But 2007, also the year that a small microblogging platform called Twitter began to spin off and scale globally, following in the footsteps of Facebook, which had just become available to everybody over the age of 13 with a valid email address. Was also the year that Google released Android and Amazon released Kindle. So that was just 20 years ago, right? So now you think about where we are now, almost, you know, 2026, a world of 8.3 billion people, 6.1 billion now have cell phones, 6 billion on the internet, 5.7 billion people active on social media, right? In this world, in just 1 minute, you have 22,000 videos uploaded to TikTok, 450,000 posts on X, over 280 million emails every single minute. And the world, as we all know, has become incredibly digitized. And obviously, that's done a lot of good things, the connectivity, the increase in economic productivity. But as we've added more devices to the internet, we've increased the points of failure and the points of vulnerability. And we've expanded the attack surface for all of that infrastructure. So now you're seeing threat actors, whether it's China, which is really the pacing threat, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and then gangs of cyber criminals, many of whom are given safe haven or sponsored by those state actors, take advantage of all that data and weaponize it. So now there's a cyber attack every 30 seconds. The average data breach costs over $5 million, and global cybercrime damages are expected to cost the world over $10 trillion just this year. So if cybercrime was a country, its gross domestic product would be the third in the world after the US and China. And so that just, when you think about that environment, that is what we're operating in. Highly connected, highly vulnerable, with threat actors looking to take advantage of this data and weaponize it. And that's why, you know, I agree with both what Jeremy and Blaise said about the threat environment. The other thing I'd say with respect to the front line, at the end of the day, the front line is a concept for people in the military, right? We talk about domains of warfare, the five domains: airspace, land, sea, and cyberspace. But in the world of cyber, there really is a sixth domain. And in many ways, it's the most important domain, and that's the private sector. You know, at the end of the day, the vast majority of critical infrastructure, and when I say critical infrastructure, it's not a technical term, Simon. It's water, it's power, it's healthcare, it's finance, it's transportation, it's communications, it's what drives our daily life. The vast majority is owned and operated by the private sector. So the private sector, more than any entity, is on the front lines of those battles. And frankly, it's why it is absolutely so critical that everything that we do in cyberspace is rooted in catalyzing the right collaboration between the government and the private sector to enable us to reduce risk to that critical infrastructure.
Schroders Capital is the private markets division of Schroders, combining the experience, the specialized local teams, with the scale, rigor, and resources of a global institutional platform. Schroders Capital provides its clients with global access to differentiated and specialized strategies encompassing all private markets asset classes, from private equity to real estate, infrastructure, and the broad universe of private debt and credit alternatives. This approach enables Schroders Capital to access opportunities and investments that are often difficult to find elsewhere, while also having the broad capabilities and perspectives needed to build holistic solutions and deliver tailored outcomes across private markets for both institutional and wealth clients. Discover more at schroderscapital.com. Remember, capital is at risk with investing. IFM Investors is a global asset manager, founded and owned by pension funds with capabilities in infrastructure equity and debt, private equity, private credit, and listed equities. They believe healthy returns depend on healthy economic, environmental, and social systems, and these are evolving on a scale never experienced before. To find opportunity, build value, and meet the needs of future generations, you need scale, skill, and expertise. That's what IFM Investors has built up over 30 years. So all of this, and perhaps some of us are guilty of coming from the post-World War II sort of order, which is being revised under, you know, this administration. It was William Burns, ex-head of the CIA, who said in an interview the other day that the US's network of partners and allies is its advantage over China and Russia. But of course, there is the sense of the burning of bridges. This cooperation and intelligence sharing, how vital is it when we think about the adversarial communities battling in cyber?
You know, it's absolutely critical. Look, at the end of the day, cybersecurity must always stay non-political. and nonpartisan, defending global cyberspace from the range of threats, you know, whether it is state-sponsored adversaries or gangs of cyber criminals that are, you know, locking hospitals up and forcing them to pay ransoms. That is not a matter of politics. And so when I was in cybersecurity, certainly in the last administration, we worked very, very hard with our international partners to ensure that we were sharing the visibility that we saw all over the world. Ukraine was a great example of this. You know, we developed a terrific partnership with Ukraine's SSSCIP, our equivalent over in Kyiv, working with all of the partners in NATO to make sure that we had a common picture of the threat environment so that we could operate against it and reduce risk to threats to our critical infrastructure. So, you know, ultimately, I think it is to the detriment of any nation to politicize cybersecurity, because we absolutely are going to rely on those close partnerships we have, whether it's with our international partners or, frankly, whether it's technology companies or business partners. We have to look at this as a fight for protection of our way of life against very vicious and aggressive adversary nations.
So let's just talk about those competencies that are required, because whilst at one level we, you know, we can take some assurance that, you know, here in the West we have this accumulated knowledge and these deep pockets, but I think the data is basically that China produces 1.4 million engineering graduates a year, which is seven times that of the US. Now, that may not speak to the quality, but it certainly suggests that if the talent pool, which is going to help advance the, you know, the skills that are required for this new world order, is the West at a disadvantage?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd say two things to that, Simon. First, we need to recognize, and this is really important for CEOs in any business, in this highly connected, highly vulnerable world that we live in, whether you're in the West or whether you're anywhere in the world, it is increasingly impossible to prevent disruption. You know, whether that's a cyber attack or a technology outage or disruption because of a weather event, geopolitical unrest, infectious disease. You know, this was one of the reasons why our friend Rob asked me to actually turn our Cyber Fusion Center into our Fusion Resilience Center, with a recognition that, frankly, there's so much out there that can disrupt your business. You actually need to assume disruption and build for resilience. And so, you know, yes, we are dealing with very vicious adversaries, and some of which invest more people and more capabilities and more resources into them. But we need to make sure that no matter what, we are prepared for disruption. And that's one of the sort of key pieces of advice that I give when I speak to CEOs and boards. It sounds very obvious, but at the end of the day, you know, it is the responsibility of all leaders to be able to leverage the power of imagination without suffering a failure of imagination. That is, you know, one of the canonical lessons from 9/11. And planning, embracing, preparing for that worst case scenario, full range of threats, doing the exercises against it, being able to recover against it, is incredibly important when you're dealing with threats like China in particular. And we can sort of talk about how I think about China. But the other thing I'd say is, look, at the end of the day, an autocratic nation like China will never be able to do what we can do in a place like the U.S. I mean, my most recent job is at the CEO of RSAC, which is essentially the largest the global cybersecurity community platform. It's rooted in Silicon Valley. And one of the things that we do is we create this innovation startup ecosystem. We've had thousands of startup companies come through, 100 acquisitions, $17.8 billion of investment. And that spirit of innovation, that spirit of experimentation, that spirit of entrepreneurialism, that fast failure, in underwriting that failure at the end of the day, I think is what will make the U.S. Continue to be incredibly successful and, you know, the engine of innovation in the world. And we're seeing it with the AI labs, frankly, and how they're really leading the world. So, you know, yes, China is a very formidable adversary, which is why we need to focus on resilience, not trying to prevent disruption. But I think, you know, we will be driven by a spirit of individual entrepreneurialism and innovation that I think will, you know, continue to drive our economy.
And just staying with China, is it possible to assess the level of competencies and expertise when one is comparing, as one might, you know, corporations operating in two different theaters?
I mean, there's a saying, you know, we think about from a threats perspective, let's leave the criminals and aside, although they're a significant portion of things that we need to be concerned about given cybercrime. But you think about the big four, really it's Russia, China that are the two, you know, most sophisticated nation state adversaries. There's a saying that, you know, Russia is the hurricane and China is climate change. So China is really the pacing adversary. I think the thing that's pretty interesting to me, and this was probably the most concerning experience I had when I was the director of CISA, was when we discovered that hackers from the Chinese People's Liberation Army had burrowed deep inside our most sensitive critical infrastructures. So I'm talking about water systems, power grid, transportation, communication. And this is the thing, Simon, it wasn't to steal our data. It wasn't to spy on us. This was not about intellectual property or economic espionage. This was very specifically to be able to launch disruptive attacks in the event of a crisis in the Taiwan Straits. So this is a world where a war in Asia would be accompanied by mass disruption, everything, everywhere, all at once. So water unavailable, power down, rail lines derailed, communication severed, all to incite societal chaos and panic and to deter our ability to marshal military might and citizen will. So this was the massive challenge that I worked on for the past 2 years of my time when I was at CISA, to be able to work with the private sector. Because again, the private sector owns and operates this critical infrastructure to help them identify, hunt for, and eradicate these hackers from the PLA. And, you know, frankly, we had some good success. But as I testified to Congress, and I've said publicly many times, what we found, we thought was just the tip of the iceberg. And that's why at the end of the day, you have to look at what you are doing to deal with disruption. You have to architect your systems, train your people, and recognize that it's all about resilience.
So there is, of course, a question here about complacency. The question that came up, are we prepared for a Lehman-style moment, not through credit contagion, but digital infrastructure failure?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I just mentioned water, power, transportation, communication. The finance sector is reliant on all of those other things to power it, right? You need power. You know, as good as the finance sector is, and I think finance was the first sector, critical infrastructure sector, to really take cybersecurity seriously. And this was off the back of, if you'll remember, in the 2012 timeframe, there were these what we call distributed denial of service attacks, where essentially web pages became unavailable because of they were being flooded with data. This was all the Iranian government back then who did that. But it really caused a bit of a wake-up call that, wow, we are actually vulnerable to these cyber attacks. So finance started basically investing a lot of resources into shoring up their security and resilience. And that's really why I ended up at Morgan Stanley in 2017. But, you know, finance is dependent upon power. It's dependent upon communications. It's dependent upon, you know, water, ultimately, if you're, you know, in terms of your employee base. And so I think you can think about the type of disruption that I just mentioned, you know, explicitly perpetrated by a nation state adversary, having a real impact across our country and across our world, frankly, because these attacks are not isolated to the U.S. And so, you know, is that something that will ultimately take down specifically the financial services sector? Maybe not, but it's something that will have a significant impact on, you know, the lives and livelihoods of the American people. Take, for example, in 2021, there was a ransomware attack against Colonial Pipeline, one of the biggest pipelines in the U.S., and it shut down for about 4 days on the East Coast, and it was a massive, huge impact on people, couldn't get to work, couldn't take their kids to school because they didn't have gas, couldn't get to the hospital. And that was a microcosm of the type of thing that we know that China was specifically planning as part of this whole campaign against our critical infrastructure. So that is something that I think we need to take very seriously. But the other thing is really the impact on the information environment and the lack of confidence. Because at the end of the day, as you know, the financial services sector and the economy all runs on confidence. You know, confidence in our data, its integrity, its accuracy, its completeness. And if you can use the information environment, which can be increasingly clouded, given some of the things with AI, you know, the line between what is real and what is fake is increasingly blurred. I think attacks against the information environment that lead to a lack of confidence, that can also have a significant impact on how the financial services sector operates. So we need to be very mindful of that as well.
And let's take an example. I think it was back in November, Ursula von der Leyen was flying on a European journey. She was crossing near Bulgarian border, systems are jammed, the pilots have to go to resort to maps and old style navigation. When something which was, suggested, and I don't suppose there's any great surprise operated by, you know, by Russian work, it's not so much the lessons as what are the practical actions that then follow to recognize the vulnerabilities? Because, of course, we've got the CEO of Delta Airlines coming on, Ed Bastian, in a couple of months' time, and we'll be talking about, you know, airline vulnerabilities. I mean, what I'm interested in is how those acts are taken and how learnings can be translated into better defense.
I mean, that's exactly the right question, right? Because at the end of the day, that's what we were trying to do when I was at CISA. And that's why those partnerships are so incredibly important. Because when something like that happens, first of all, you want to understand as much as you can about that incident from a technical perspective, an operational perspective, a legal perspective, ultimately a policy perspective, and then share that information widely. Understand the threat, and then understand very specifically what you need to be doing to mitigate that specific threat, but also threats like that, adjacent threats. And that's where this whole idea of imagination comes in. You know, we have seen so many attacks over the last four decades since we saw the first cyber attack, famously the Morris Worm in 1988. And we need to make sure that we are thinking very broadly about what are the types of attacks that we will see in the future, particularly knowing that capabilities like AI can turbocharge some of these attacks. I mentioned earlier, these phishing emails, right? Somebody sends an email that gets you to try and click on it, then you lose all the money in your bank account. You'll remember even a couple years ago, it was very easy to spot those phishing emails, right? And now, because of the massive amount of data that's out there, much of the data we've put on social media, threat actors are using that to train systems to create hyper-personalized, hyper-tailored phishing emails that would be very hard to detect, and people will click on it. And again, there'll be a lot of financial issues around, you know, people losing money or being fooled into giving away money or making certain transfers. So it's really taking what we know from current threats, extrapolating in what we will see in the coming months and years, and then doing everything we can, working with our partners to prepare for it. So every threat that is out there, we should think about how that could be 10x'd and then how we will prepare for it and exercise against that. Some of those tabletop exercises that, you know, are the things that always get pushed and pushed and pushed because there's something else happening in the business. Those are actually really, really important to be able to get everybody in the business together to prepare for something and understand how you're going to ultimately respond and recover to very significant threats to your business.
And would it be fair to say that boards are generally complacent?
What I've seen over the past several years is boards are increasingly waking up to the fact that cyber risk can be an existential risk, whether it's reputational or whether it just costs you an enormous amount of money. That can ultimately, you know, really significant impact your business model. So increasingly, I think boards get that cyber risk is a business risk that needs to be managed as a matter of good governance. I see a move in many public companies from cyber risk being managed as part of the audit committee to being managed as part of the technology risk or cybersecurity and risk committee. I think that's a very, very good trend because, again, you know, everything is so connected these days. Everything is so digitized. Everything is so vulnerable. Supply chains are increasingly difficult to be able to secure, just given where we are in the world and the threat environment. And, you know, frankly, if boards are complacent about cyber risk, they are complacent at their peril. And they should be held accountable if there is an incident that actually impacts their business.
Well, I mean, I was having a conversation not very long ago with a large financial institution, and I was just talking about, I thought the way they presented themselves in sort of old-fashioned PowerPoint was missing more than one trick, and that they should review sort of some of the other stuff that our little organization has learned over the last few years. And the answer was yes, but you have to understand is that technology is viewed here as a cost center. And I think that therein lies in many institutions a historic way of operating, which is a problem.
Well, so this is the thing. I mean, going back to, you know, Morgan Stanley, this was a huge lesson learned to me and one that I've sort of carried through. I was brought there to build something called our Cyber Fusion Center. And this was an ability to essentially understand, detect, and respond to cyber threats. And I think the reason they hired me is when I was at the White House, I had just stood up something called the Hostage Recovery Fusion Center. And so fusion centers are very common in the world of counterterrorism, because it's all about connecting the dots that were not connected during 9/11. So when I get to Morgan Stanley to stand up this thing, the business was like, how much is this going to cost me? Right? That was the attitude. But what we were able to do was to build something that you could then bring clients into and help clients, very importantly, understand, here's the threat environment and why you need to be concerned about it. Here are the analytics that we are building to detect those threats against the bank and against your assets. And here's how we're responding to mitigate risk. And so by bringing clients in, both current clients, but very importantly, prospective clients, we were able to actually turn what was a cost center into, frankly, a revenue driver.
Got it.
And that was incredibly important for the business and for the cybersecurity team.
So you talked about spycraft, and you've been involved in hostage negotiations, cyber terrorism. You're sitting across all those branches, and spycraft's as old as man. And so I'm quite intrigued about how the world of espionage is both responding to and taking advantage of the new tools at their disposal.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting when you think about the world of espionage, and I was not on the human side. You know, the CIA side, or I guess MI6 side, I was on the NSA side, which is all about collecting foreign intelligence to help inform how policymakers make decisions or how militaries can actually project power and be successful in operations. You know, it's interesting when you think about spycraft and human operations in particular. I think, and you know, you should talk to the MI6 folks about this or you know, our friend Dave Petraeus, but increasingly difficult to do human operations in a world where it's very hard to be anonymous, right? In a world where you have biometrics, where you have a lot of surveillance, it is increasingly difficult to be a spy, if you were. And that's why at the end of the day, the most important thing is to be able to work with our partners to leverage the power of technology to understand where the threats are and what we can do to drive down risk to, you know, global cyberspace, to critical infrastructure, global security, economic prosperity. And so the collection of intelligence is much more technological, digital, electronic these days than it is about human intelligence.
So I had two questions which seem appropriate to ask. Now, one was from General Senator Carter, who was the Chief of Defense Staff. He said that how should government guidance change in terms of negotiating with ransomware criminals as there was for terrorists?
Yeah. Wow, that's another long story. Well, I'll try to make it a short one. But, you know, when I was the head of counterterrorism in the White House, this was in the second term of the Obama administration. So I was there from 2013 to 2016. And as you'll recall, that was the period of ISIS, right? ISIS took down Mosul, and then we saw terrorist attacks around the world. Now, in 2014, in August, ISIS beheaded several American and British journalists and aid workers. You'll remember Jim Foley, Stephen Sotloff, David Haynes, Alan Henning, Peter Kasig, and then Kayla Mueller. And that was, you know, probably one of the worst moments of my life, because I was actually part of a hostage rescue operation, the planning for it. That was an incredibly daring and complex hostage rescue operation in the dead of night in Syria that sadly failed to actually get the hostages that were being held. But off the back of the beheadings, the just horrific beheadings, President Obama asked my team and I to develop a new hostage policy, one that would allow us to be much more effective in bringing hostages home safely. And as part of that, the Department of Justice actually looked at the policy that was related to ransoms. And at the end of the day, ransoms were considered illegal. And the Justice Department didn't say that they're not illegal, but they basically said that they were not going to prosecute any family that paid a ransom to get their children back from terrorists, which as it was seen at the time, was a much more humane policy. So it's interesting because that's the lens through which I see ransoms and ransoms, you know, as in human hostages. On the ransom side of the house, in terms of ransomware specifically, I know there's some discussions in this country about outlawing payment for ransomware. I think the thing that we'd have to think about are things like hospitals that, you know, are a great target for ransomware criminals. If you prevent hospitals or other certain types of, you know, life-saving critical infrastructure from being able to pay a ransom, that will have very significant impacts, frankly, on that entity that could lead to lives being lost. So I think it's not a cut and dry thing about whether you pay a ransom or don't pay a ransom. I think you have to really think about what the downside impacts will be. You know, obviously anything that fuels the ransomware ecosystem, which as I said, is sort of a $10 trillion business model, anything that fuels that is not a good thing because it allows them to just continue their work. But I don't think that means that we should just say you can no longer pay a ransom. So it's been one of the trickier issues, which is why I think the other levers of power are actually going to be more effective against ransomware criminals, whether it's, you know, indictments or using legal process. And there have been many successful international legal operations that have been able to go after some of these criminals. But look, at the end of the day, I think the only way to turn ransomware from a multi-trillion dollar business into a shocking anomaly is to ensure that the software that we rely upon every hour of every day is designed to be much more secure. You know, I talked about those hackers from the PLA, Simon. They were not using exotic cyber weapons as well-resourced, as sophisticated as Chinese hackers are. They were just taking advantage of common flaws and defects in the software that we rely upon every day. And so the problem in many ways is of our own making. We are relying upon flaws and defects that has been allowed to exist in our software for decades because of, you know, from an economic issue, it's a credence good,
yep.
Right? It's consumers don't really understand what they're looking for from software security, so they don't know what to ask for. So businesses are not incentivized or rewarded to provide it. They are incentivized to provide speed to market features, driving down cost and convenience. And that, frankly, is the original sin. It's what created the cybersecurity aftermarket. And you can't blame vendors because, again, it's economically rational for them not to be prioritizing security in a world that doesn't demand it.
The other question that actually came from Rob Rooney was, how should democracies respond when adversaries use cyber operations to stay below the threshold of armed conflict?
Well, so that's the question, right? I talked about hackers from the Chinese PLA pre-positioning cyber weapons in our critical infrastructure. Now, you could say, because those cyber weapons have not been activated, that's ostensibly below the threshold, because it's just holding our critical infrastructure at risk as opposed to necessarily launching attacks. But think about that as sort of bombs sitting inside our water systems, our power systems. Now, in my view, as somebody who commanded the Army's first cyber operations battalion and helped to stand up U.S. Cyber Command, which specifically focused on allowing us and enabling us to project power in cyberspace, I actually think it's incredibly important that we are using our capabilities in an offensive way to hold our adversaries at risk. So, you know, one of the things I'd give credit to the current administration is I think they have been more forward-leaning in terms of using very good cyber capabilities. Think about Cyber Command. We created it in 2009. It's now 2026. Huge amount of increase in capability and capacity in offensive cyber. From what I've been reading publicly, and I'm no longer in the know, but they've used offensive cyber capabilities in recent operations in Venezuela and in Iran in precision ways to be effective and successful. And I think that's actually important for that to be out there publicly, because it sends a message to our adversaries that these are capabilities that we have. They are exquisite capabilities that we will use to hold your critical infrastructure at risk and to impose costs on you if you threaten our infrastructure, if you threaten our economy, and if you threaten our way of life.
Right. So I'm going to move towards some closing questions. I noticed that you sat on the Morgan Stanley Foundation, which was a portfolio I used to run when I was at Morgan Stanley. So you are obviously, you allocate, and you think about allocating capital. At a very high level, when you think about those decisions confronting, and that's largely our audience on a global basis, where would you prefer to place more of your bets than not?
I mean, at the end of the day, I think, and we're seeing it, right? The technology is driving economic prosperity. You know, it's having a lot of perverse effects as well that I've talked about in terms of the connectivity and the lack of security, but it is driving a huge amount of what is powering, you know, our economy around the world. So the incredible investments that are happening specifically with AI, I think are a good place to invest in. But I think we have to be very mindful of how we are investing and who we are investing in. And I'm talking specifically about decisions made with respect to the Frontier Labs. So when you think about these technologies, I always love to go back to this great quote from biologist E.O. Wilson. You're probably familiar with him. He said, you know, the problem of humanity today is we have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology, right? So when you think about the fact that we have this incredibly powerful, incredibly fast-moving technology, we have to make sure that we are putting the right institutions in place to govern it and to secure it. So when we are investing in this technology, specifically in AI and all the things that will enable AI, so data centers, the infrastructure like that, the power for it, we also need to keep in mind that the companies that are working hard to ensure that they are putting their own guardrails in place to reduce risks, the risks of these technologies, I think that's where people should do their homework on understanding which companies are being most are most serious about safety and security of these very powerful capabilities. So I would advise looking towards that.
Well, I think we have a lot of due diligence in our business when people go and sit in front of, you know, managers and entities and cross-examine them. And it's been a while since I've been in that room, but I suspect the nature of those questions needs to change quite a lot, because I think it's more analog than digital, quite frankly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the end of the day, nobody was asking about, you know, software when software started eating the world. Nobody was saying, how safe is your software? Right. That, you know, Ralph Nader's 1965 book, Unsafe at Any Speed, really led to seatbelts and airbags. And what we need is the unsafe at any CPU speed or GPU speed equivalent, which is we are building this, you know, godlike technology that's going to do incredible things for us, but we need to make sure it's serving humanity and not destroying humanity. So the questions to be asked now are, what are you doing to secure this technology and ensure that it is as safe as possible to be used by my business? Very important from an enterprise level, because you know, you need to make sure that you're taking care of your clients, but also, you know, our families and communities are using these technologies. So we have to ask those questions at the beginning, not at the lag, not as a bolt on.
I also love the fact that you've had three great quotations today. You said to me that I probably know them, which I absolutely didn't. However, they've been written down and will be used again. And I love using quotations. So thank you for the help in my erudition, or at least the impression that I know what I'm talking about.
Proud to serve.
Okay. So some concluding general questions. What is the summit or summits for you still to scale?
You know, I have been very blessed throughout my life to do, you know, some amazing things and to serve with some incredible people. And, you know, I'll give you one more quote, because I love learning from people. And that is, you know, Jonas Salk, the inventor of the polio vaccine, said, "Our greatest responsibility is to be good ancestors." So everything in my life is seen through the eyes of my son, and all of the things that I can do to make sure that he is set up for success. So the summits are all about, like, being the example for him to be able to hit his summits as opposed to my own personal summits.
We support GAIN, which is Girls Are Investors here in the UK, a really important charity, getting women into the investment business where they're underrepresented. And, you know, it's a great charity. Advice, we often ask this, but advice for young women thinking about career choices?
Yeah, I mean, go for it. Do not let anybody in your life tell you you can't do something. Right?
Now, I know that you are very keen on your music, so I have to ask you either your favorite band or your favorite piece of music.
Oh, man, Simon, music is my life.
Like, okay.
Music is my, you know, and there's a great TV show, Ted Lasso, right. Which you probably know, right. Which is like, football is life. For me, it's music is life. So I can't even give you, you know, one genre and song. But coming over here, I was listening to Iggy Pop, English Beat, Eddie Vedder doing Save It For Later. It's just music. It's me. Music is life.
Fantastic. We did a great episode with Philip Morris of Cutting Edge Group that has just merged with Warner Brothers Music. And they talked about the insertion of music into films and what a great, you know, business is. It's a fascinating business and it's a fascinating conversation. Where's the place you most want to visit?
I've never been on safari in Africa. If you'd asked me this last week, I would have said Iceland, but I got to go snorkeling in the Silfra, the transcontinental divide. So that was pretty awesome. So safari.
So I'm going to stop there. I mean, we planned this a couple of months ago, and I think I started doing my initial research and I became more and more engrossed in the things that you've done and achieved, an extraordinary journey that seems to me like it's, you know, only partially completed. So we'll be watching the future movements. But as I sum up, my goodness me, the statement you made that cyber crime, if it was an economic entity, would be the third largest economy in the world, is something pause for thought. The preparedness or lack thereof at a board level, and because boards have operated and they have all of the legacy baggage, the need to revisit that with urgency and alacrity seems perhaps, you know, supremely important. And it's impossible to prevent disruption. So accepting that, it's all of the things that you can do around it, because we live in a world where these are not going away. Imagining that these things aren't going to affect us is, you know, irresponsible. Yeah. Jen, what a pleasure to have you here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Simon. Great to be with you.